Your support is important to Living on Earth. Donate today by pressing the donate link on the left of this page. Every bit helps. And thanks.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Curwood at the climate negotiations in Copenhagen, Denmark. Back when the Kyoto Protocol was first put together in 1997, UN climate negotiators were not able to decide how to handle land use changes and their effects on climate. But as greenhouse gas emissions have continued to rise, a big part of it has been the loss and degradation of tropical forests. This time, negotiators are determined to get a deal to limit emissions from land use change, and incentives to protect tropical forests are at the top of the list. We sent Living on Earth's Ingrid Lobet and Mitra Taj to Indonesia, where the clearing and burning of forests and the draining of carbon-rich peatlands make it the third biggest emitter of global warming gases, behind only China and the United States. Their mission? To see up close the obstacles and opportunities for what climate negotiators call RED, that is, the reduction of emissions from deforestation and degradation. We begin our series from Indonesia with Ingrid Lobet on the island of Sumatra.
To see what drives the Indonesian economy, just get out on the road. Even before sunrise, you see truck after truck loaded with orange palm fruits. Palm oil is big business around the world for cooking oil, detergent, and fuel. And there are still more trucks laden with logs to make paper. Soon, our car stops so Arman, the driver, can have a smoke. Where we've stopped, the forest is burnt away, most likely to make way for oil palm trees. In a distant stand of forest, we hear gibbons. As he smokes, Armin says he used to hunt them, but not anymore.
In the forest, I came across one of these animals. I shot it 4 times, and it fell out of the tree and leaned against it, crying. It was holding a baby.
Nah, sambil menangis, tapi sudah itu baru dikasihkan anaknya ke saya.
It cried like a human. There were tears and it sniffed. She handed her baby to me, then sank down and died. That's when I stopped shooting animals that act like humans.
Berupa manusia akalnya itu.
The sound comes from way in the distance. As the trees are cut, the animals are being pushed further out.
Karena hutannya udah nggak ada, jadi dia mencari.
They don't know where to find food anymore.
The disappearance of the forests here in Riau has been so swift. It's well documented by the environmental group WWF. But Jono Toro, who's worked here in Riau for the forestry ministry for 13 years, put it best.
Jadi pada tahun 96 itu masih bagus ya.
Back in 1996, the forest here was still good. But after 1998, after the end of the Suharto era, it was a free-for-all. People just cut the forest as they please. There was no law enforcement. Now there is only 20 to 30% of the forest left here in Riau province. That is mostly in the national parks. And even the forest there is degraded.
Taman nasional yang kondisinya juga rusak.
Much of the vanished forest has given way to oil palm and to trees for paper. The voracious hunger for copier paper and for paper packaging, most recently in Asia, is bringing money and foreigners to giant new paper mills in once quiet outposts.
My name is Dave Kerr, and I work for April in Kerinci, Indonesia.
April, or Asia Pacific Resources Limited, is one of the largest pulp and paper companies in the world. And David Kerr, a boat-building hobbyist who once worked in paper in eastern Canada, now directs operations here at this mill, really a small town in itself.
It's going to be really loud here.
What is this?
This is the chipping operations. You'll see the logs going into the chipper and disappearing. Each chipper can take 3,000 or 4,000 tons per day.
Seven shipping lines swallow acacia trunks whole and in seconds spit out thumb-sized chips of wood.
So after this, the chip goes to the digesters where it's cooked and turned into pulp.
Pulp is the raw ingredient for paper, something the world can't seem to get enough of. April's Kerinci complex produced 800,000 tons this year.
We're about to enter real paper. This is the press section and the forming area.
Inside, the wet paper is squeezed between giant rollers, then dried, starched, and at nearly a mile a minute, crisp white paper spins onto enormous spools that each weigh more than 20 pickup trucks. The process is so fast, it's dizzying, and so loud and hot, April employees monitor progress from an air-conditioned control room. They're looking for tears or breaks in the giant sheets.
A good day, one or two breaks per day. A bad day, sometimes as much as 10.
Does it run 24/7?
24/7, 365. The only time we stop is for maintenance, and that's usually measured in hours up to 12.
The sheets are cut and stacked, then it's on to a printer or copier, maybe near you. But this hunger for paper and palm oil and the forest felling that goes with it is overwhelming even Indonesia's vast forests. So as the country pursues development and the plantations expand, they're spreading over a very special landscape, tropical peatland. And the ground is a mix of acacia branches, bark, and tree material that's part of this dark brown and black peat soil. This open field was once a tropical peatland forest, a landscape unfamiliar to most Americans. Intact, it was soupy or spongy, hard to walk through. Peat forms when the water table is at ground level or even higher. Submerged, without air, plant material doesn't decompose. It just gets compacted into a treasure trove of stored carbon. Left alone for millions of years, it would turn into coal. But if you drain away the water by cutting canals or ditches, tropical peatlands dry out and their vast carbon stores escape into the atmosphere. In this field, a crop of pulpwood trees has just been harvested, and a new one is being planted.
My name is John Bathgate. I'm a forester with a PhD in forestry. My title at the moment is Plantation Best Practices Manager.
Bathgate is an outdoorsy New Zealander who spent 10 months living in the forest among illegal tree cutters. Indonesia has vast peatlands. This island alone, Sumatra, stores more carbon in peat than is emitted globally by human activities in a year. Now much of the peat, like what we're walking on, is drained and emitting carbon at a furious rate. Many environmentalists blame plantations like this one, but Bathgate says his company is not to blame.
Just over here where these bigger trees are, there's a small river. This river's been used probably for centuries or longer by local people for fishing and hunting and gathering, and more recently for taking out timber for sale. So this land here has had quite a history of degradation, and we would call abuse, or at least not professional high-tech development.
When April planted its first crop of pulp trees on this land, he says, it was already barren. Villagers, he says, had already hacked canals into the swamp, both to float out trees they cut and to plant crops.
If before April came, this was virgin forest with a water table at the surface, then yes, we've got a lot to answer for. But it was like this over here. It was already had quite a lot of illegal logging, small drains through here.
Today, contract workers wielding heavy tampers pound the ground into flat spaces for new seedlings. I lean down close to capture the sound as the tool hits the ground, but there's virtually none. The peat absorbs it. Peat is spongy. It gives by 2 or 3 inches on every time this man puts his foot down. These workers are planting seedlings of acacia, the species favored by this industry. That's because acacia grows fast, an inch a day. It sounds incredible, but in this climate, John Bathgate says these trees can be harvested for paper in just 5 years.
So it's absolutely fantastic growth. Coupled with the fact that the high rainfall here, nearly 3,000 millimetres a year, and the fact that the peat is like a big sponge absorbing and holding the moisture. So moisture for growth is available all year round. As well as that, it's a very fine fibred for growing very soft, high-quality writing paper.
And if that weren't enough to explain why the paper industry loves these trees, peat soils are quite acidic, below a pH of 4, so acacia grows this fast even with its roots marinating in the equivalent of grapefruit juice. On a big bare spot in this sea of paper trees, the giant claw of a Hitachi excavator grabs skinny logs out of a metal boat. The cut logs floated in from the far reaches of the plantation on a canal, one of hundreds the industry carves into the peat. These canals cause carbon release. But in what's becoming a high-stakes game of competing carbon claims, Bathgate says April's acacia plantations actually reduce carbon emissions overall.
Absolutely. What we're saying for the peatlands, we turn it from a large emitter to a less large emitter. There will still be some net emissions. On peatland, on average, we're reducing the emissions by something in the order of 50%.
The company claims it cuts emissions by preventing fire and by setting aside 35% of its concessions where forest is allowed to grow back with the water level high. In Bathgate's view, the paper business is less harmful than the death by a thousand cuts of poor people felling and burning the forest to plant their rice and rubber trees.
I'm absolutely 100% convinced that leaving it to continue to degrade and leaving it for other parties to continue to degrade could get worse.
But many peatland experts don't share this benign view of the plantations spreading across Indonesia. Marcel Silvius is a tropical soils expert in the Netherlands. He's lived in Indonesia, speaks the language, and was among the first scientists to point out peat's importance for carbon storage.
A lot of the peat swamp forests in Indonesia are degraded, and I would say about 90% of the peat swamp forests are degraded at the moment in Indonesia, in western Indonesia. But that doesn't mean that you then have a license to go on with and even to increase that degradation by putting plantations in place of the remaining natural forest.
Silvia says April's claim that plantations benefit the level of carbon in the atmosphere is just not credible. The acacia trees, he says, require at least the first 2 feet of peat soil to be drained, and that is not sustainable for a peat ecosystem.
Peat is a soil that is consisting of organic carbon that's accumulated by the falling of leaves and the decay of roots and tree trunks over thousands of years because of the waterlogged situation. And that carbon will only remain in the soil when the water levels in the area remain high. And what plantations do is they actually take the water out. When you remove the water, the carbon will go up in the air because the soil carbon will react with the oxygen of the air and becomes carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas, so it warms up the earth.
Silvius's organization, Wetlands International, estimates that in the 1990s alone, Sumatra lost 18% of the carbon in its soil. And when, after years, peatlands have finally given off their carbon, the damage isn't over.
When the water is drained out of the peat, the soil will subside. It will become lower and lower, and then you get increased floods. In the coastal peat swamps of Indonesia, you could get saltwater intrusion, which means that, in effect, you will render an area totally unproductive after perhaps a period of 30 to 50 years.
In place of plantations, Silvius offers a different prescription for damaged peatlands. Restore them. And that takes us to perhaps Indonesia's ground zero for forest carbon and the international money that could help keep it in the ground. A giant lowland peat storehouse known as the Kampar Peninsula. Recently, the group Greenpeace constructed a climate defenders camp, complete with kitchens, solar electricity, and bunks for volunteers on one corner of this forested stretch in hope of attracting world attention. People from the villages nearby filled a new outdoor meeting room for the opening of the activist camp.
At a very critical time, all of us are sitting in a very important place Saat ini kita semua berada pada suatu waktu yang sangat penting, momen yang sangat penting, dan kita sekarang duduk di atas tanah yang sangat penting.
Protection of Kampar Peninsula is not only important for the people who live around here or for the biodiversity, but it is also important to stabilize global climate.
Dan hutan ini bukan hanya hutan yang diwariskan dari nenek moyang kita kepada
This peat-rich peninsula perfectly illustrates the maneuvering taking place in forested parts of the globe as players try to guarantee that global investments in forest carbon flow to them. Kampar consists of one giant dome of sodden peat. It's a rainwater-driven landscape with ground and below-ground flows from the center to the periphery into the ocean. April's John Bathgate says plantations on the periphery can protect those all-important deep carbon stores in the middle.
So we are one of the players that have done quite a lot of the work on looking at the value of the core and how the core could be fully protected, because that needs to happen.
April calculates plantations will reduce emissions in the periphery, or what it calls the Kampar Ring, and it hopes to market credits for that saved carbon directly to international investors.
The figure we come up with is about a reduction of about 2.6 million tonnes of CO2 per hectare per year. At a conservative value of $10, there's $26 million a year. To actually then be fed back into protecting the core of the Kampar Peninsula, which is where the really large carbon is, and providing benefits for stakeholders. It's not just our carbon. I mean, the carbon belongs to the people of Indonesia. The Ministry of Forestry of Indonesia has a stake. Local communities have a stake.
But peat expert Marcel Silvius has a different idea that he says would raise more money. Let the government sell carbon credits through the emerging UN forest finance system, and with the proceeds, employ local people in ecology, blocking up the old illegal logging canals and restoring Kampar's damaged outer periphery.
Why not just immediately restore the hydrology of the area and with that stop the soil emissions, and then plant indigenous tree species which do not require drainage and actually can make a lot of money on it? From an area like Kampar, it is easy to get something like $30 to $50 million per year in carbon credit benefits. So we're really talking about a new and a massive opportunity for conservation.
In order to make this plan work for Kampar, the Indonesian government would need to be on board. That's part of why Greenpeace opened its camp. But after activists chained themselves to an April excavator recently, many of the foreign activists were deported. Still, Greenpeace workers like Bustar Maitar managed to get out the message to the newly re-elected Indonesian president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, known here as SBY.
So if the SBY want to make a difference, he's supposed to be starting from here to protect the peatland forest because, 40% of the greenhouse gases in Indonesia is coming from the peatland destruction. So this is very important. SBY starting his commitment to reduce the greenhouse gases and starting from here. He can make a change starting from here in Kampar Peninsula.
Kampar is not the only deep peatland in Indonesia. Next, our team heads further south in Karamutan, where red may hold the promise of more sustainable development for people on the edges of survival. That's just ahead on Living on Earth. Stay tuned.
Support for the Environmental Health Desk at Living on Earth comes from the Cedar Tree Foundation. Support also comes from the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Fund for coverage of population and the environment, and from Gilman Ordway for coverage of conservation and environmental change. This is Living on Earth on PRI, Public Radio International.